should have trust machines for everything. You know, if I have a check for whatever amount, it doesn't matter. I put it in the ATM and just assume that it's going to be fine. And my wife is still with the older, previous generation who says you have to go to the counter. And I assume when something goes into a machine, it's going to be fine. And so having it eat my credit card has shaken my faith in the universe. Nonetheless, I'm hoping that by the time we're done, my wife will have heard back from them that they have found it. More likely shredded it, but at least it's safe. But in any case, I'm glad to be here this morning, and thank you, Sandra, and thank you, David, for arranging this. Our topic, as you see on the sheets, is sharp practice and ethical courtroom conduct. So what I'd like to do is deal with this from the perspective of law society and from the perspective as well of Jewish tradition. And in order to do that, I need to begin by defining what we're talking about. What is sharp practice? What are our concerns? And there are two separate statements in the Rules of Professional Conduct that bear on this. If you take a look on your sheets at the first source, Rule 4 is one, and then Rule 6 is another. So this is doubtless all familiar to you, but because I'm not a lawyer, it's all interesting to me. Taking a look at Rule 4 in source number 1, 4.01.1, when acting as an advocate, a lawyer shall represent the client resolutely and honorably within the limits of the law, while treating the tribunal with candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect. So this is usually what's simply called basic civility. That's what we're talking about, so much so that I found it funny when reading this for the first time that this was in the Rules of Professional Conduct. Generally speaking, we assume if something is written into the rules, it's because there's a problem. There's an anticipation that it won't work. Nonetheless, candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect. And then further, when acting as an advocate, a lawyer shall not deliberately refrain from informing the tribunal of any binding authority that the lawyer considers to be directly on point and that has not been mentioned by an opponent. So if you know that there's some precedent, if you know that there is some reason to argue a certain way, apparently, according to this, if it's not mentioned by the opponent, you're supposed to mention it. Now, I'm not clear on what the bounds of that are. And that I will leave for, in terms of what the bounds of it are, I will leave for a substantive discussion. But both of these points are under relationship to the administration of justice. In other words, the individual lawyer is obligated to make sure that justice will be served, and number one, has to act with honor, candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect as part of respect for the administration of justice. And number two, has to make sure not to conceal information that will potentially affect the administration of justice. That's Rule 4. Is that rule clear? Okay. The second rule is Rule 6, and that's in source number 2. And this comes under relationship to the society and other lawyers. A lawyer shall conduct himself or herself in such a way as to maintain the integrity of the profession. A lawyer shall be courteous, civil, and act in good faith with all persons with whom the lawyer has dealings in the course of his or her practice. Play nicely. And a lawyer shall avoid sharp practice and shall not take advantage of or act without fair warning upon slips, irregularities, or mistakes on the part of other legal practitioners not going to the merits or involving the sacrifice of a client's rights. So this last one about sharp practice is particularly interesting to me in terms of trying to figure out what exactly is included and what exactly is not included. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on that. But basically what we're suggesting here is that the lawyer has a set of responsibilities to justice and a set of responsibilities to other lawyers and the legal profession. There's some overlap. Both of those involve being civil and acting with candor and being courteous and so on. And then in addition, we talk about making sure not to harm the administration of justice in Law 4, and in Law 6, not taking advantage of slips, irregularities, or mistakes not going to the merits of the case. This also fits this idea that I have a responsibility to the administration of justice, and I have a separate responsibility to other lawyers and to the legal profession. It fits in with an idea that I've seen written about called the five duties. Right? You have the duty to the public, to the courts, to the client, to the fellow lawyer, and to third parties. So, looking at this, specifically sharp practice for a moment, can someone give me an example of sharp practice? Preferably not something you have done. But, you know, it's all fair game. It's casual Friday. Can you give me an example of sharp practice? No sharp practice here, huh? Sandra.
Just as an example here, that in the press there had been a lot of talk over the last number of years about particular attorney, the lawyer in Toronto, Joe Broyna, who, when you read the actual comments that he made, it was interesting that the complaint arose from the judge saying something as opposed to the client's function at the law site.
Mm-hmm. But what was what made it sharp practice?
That comments were he called the lawyers of the OSC incompetent, but they were
I wouldn't characterize that. I mean, there's a lot of controversy surrounding that.
Yeah.
That I sent for appeal, and I frankly don't think he did anything wrong.
Well, calling someone incompetent, I think if it's an issue would fit under the problem of lack of respect and civility, but I'm not sure I'd call that sharp practice.
Sharp practice would be like generally speaking, like in litigation, you have to file a statement of defense within a certain period of time. Mm-hmm. If you write to the lawyer on the other side and say I need more time, and I assume that I have your consent unless you tell me otherwise, you give reasonable notice. Then they go and not be like the fault.
Mm-hmm. So what makes that sharp practice of that is that there was some kind of an understanding, and then I went back on my agreement, acting within the bounds of the law, but not within the bounds of that which I had committed to. Right? Am I understanding that correctly? Yeah.
Sharp practice in the days before technology might have.
Yeah.
It would be sending an hour before the after the judge or the client's appeal, an 82-page agreement, not for that.
Right. So if you send the agreement without enough time for them to reasonably read it and do something about it, that's what I'm understanding?
Yeah, that's personal.
Got it. Okay. As the recipient rather than the sender. So my understanding is, in general, and I think the cases that you're giving, both of those cases fit within this, sharp practice would refer to actions that are true to the letter of the law, but not to the spirit of the law, and take advantage of the other side. The example that I found, did I bring it on here? Yes, if you take a look at number 3, this is an example I found out at BC. When a caveat has been filed in one Supreme Court registry, but not in others through inadvertence, as I understand it, if one wants to file a caveat to prevent a will from being executed, it's supposed to be filed in a particular registry, and then it's automatically cross-filed. That's my limited understanding as a non-lawyer. In Section 133 of the Estate Administration Act says, the registrar in whose registry a caveat has been filed has a duty to promptly notify the registrar of the Supreme Court in Victoria, who shall promptly notify all the other registrars in the province. So there's supposed to be some kind of notification. So if a caveat has been filed, and then someone who was supposed to do the notification dropped the ball, not the lawyer who did the filing, it's not his job, it's somebody else who didn't do it, but the lawyer knows that it wasn't the notification wasn't spread around. It is sharp practice for a lawyer to apply for letters of administration without notifying the lawyer who filed the caveat of the proposed application. So I guess it's the other way around. It's not the it's not that this lawyer knows. It's the one who wants the will to be executed, as opposed to the one who wants it to be blocked. The one who wants to execute it knows that he can get away with it. And so moves to have the will carried out without notifying the lawyer who filed the caveat that this is going to happen, because somewhere along the line someone dropped the ball. So it's taking advantage of a mistake within the letter of the law, but taking advantage of the other person's ignorance, which in this case the circumstances should never have come about. That's one possibility, is where you act within the law and as a result are able to take advantage of the other side and their ignorance in a particular case.
So,
yeah.
So sometimes, for example, in the proxy contest where you're fighting, there are tactics that you might use to give yourself an advantage. An example of that, you and I were involved in earlier this year, where, without getting into all the details, there's a form of proxy, and how and the way that people vote. You can either, for example, you can say, I want to vote for this whole group on the table, or I want to vote individually. And so the company has an idea of how it should be done. The other side puts in a proxy that's different, and then the company decides, well, maybe we'll wait a little bit before we tell them that their former proxy is problematic. We'll wait in the weeds a little bit, then we'll do it, then they have to scramble to try and fix it or react. So we know that what they're doing is problematic. We're thinking tactically is the one we want to let them know.
That's a good question. Well, I'll tell you what I would actually think is, it's not sharp practice per se. It may be a related point. When we talked about, if you take a look on, if you take a look at number 2, 6.033. Not take advantage of or act without fair warning upon slips, irregularities, or mistakes. This, I understand, is a separate point from sharp practice. And you're talking about specifically mistakes on the part of other legal practitioners not going to the merits or involving the sacrifice of a client's rights. So the truth of the matter is, I did a session on this about a year ago, for lawyers in a synagogue context rather than in a firm context. And we had a lot of fun discussing the question of what doesn't involve the sacrifice of a client's rights. Meaning, it seems clear to me, assuming that in the proxy case you're talking about, it's not that they made a mistake that was directly relevant in law, it was some other filing error of some kind. They wrote it up wrong. You'll say, well, it's not going to the merits, and therefore I should notify them. On the other hand, I'm sacrificing the rights of my client by notifying them in such a way that they're going to have an opportunity to correct the mistake. So I have a problem with this in terms of trying to understand where it applies and where it doesn't. I think that if someone were to employ the tactic that we're talking about and then get questioned on it, I think they would have the ability to point to the rights of the client and say, well, my understanding was this would have been sacrificing the rights of the client, but I'm not sure. I could see it both ways. Yeah.
In many commercial corporate leagues, you have a provision which simply says that you can't fight in the weeds. So you must disclose an error that you know about.
Right.
When you find out about it. Different context, maybe, but nonetheless, I'm not clear that you can't fight in the weeds.
Right. Right, see, that's the thing. If you're going to tell me that contracts state in them you may not do this, then that means in the absence of such a clause, it's understood that may well happen.
That's not binding on the lawyers. That's not binding on the parties.
Okay.
That's binding on the parties, not the lawyers.
See, the case that I'm familiar with that I look at in terms of this sort of a situation, I brought a number 4. Also, as a result of a document published in B.C., in negotiations between two lawyers with respect to a transaction, lawyer A receives from lawyer B draft 5 of the agreement between the clients. A clause that lawyer B emphasized was very important to her client in a previous draft is missing from the latest draft. and does not seem to be covered by other parts of the agreement. So you've been going around and around with your drafts. You know there was something that the other side cared about and was not willing to negotiate on. And suddenly in the latest draft, it's not here. It's clearly a victim of cut and paste. Right? This is not, they didn't change their mind and suddenly decide we're going to give in on this without even notifying the other side. They, so it's typographical error of a kind. So their belief is and this is from the Law Society in BC, that this would constitute taking advantage of an error of the other side not going to the merits of the case. Now, you could respond and say that's if I don't notify them at all. But what if I notify them as we're about to sign? So that then they have to think to themselves, do we want to go back and put this back in, or maybe give them an incentive to simply move forward without that which they had expected. So that would be another type of concern, this taking advantage of error of the other side. So that's a second issue, meaning these are two different points. Sharp practice, as I understand it, is more of a case of action, where I do something which is within the letter of the law, but not within the spirit of the law and the agreements that I have made. That's sharp practice. Whereas, there's a separate point, which is taking advantage of an error that they made that doesn't speak to the merits of the case. It's not about the actual legal issues. And then there's a third category, which hopefully doesn't need examples. But it's the issue of civility, which I'll get to at the end. But actually, I did note, if you take a look at number 5, that same BC document has a case that they say is permissible in terms of taking advantage of an error on the other side. I forgot that I had included this. Lawyer A states in a conversation with Lawyer B that she will be issuing a writ against Lawyer B's client well within the limitation period, which she says is 2 years. She says, I'm going to take care of this within the 2-year limitation period. In fact, Lawyer B knows the limitation period is shorter than that stated by Lawyer A. But Lawyer B has made no comment himself on what the limitation period is. So I didn't mislead them. I didn't tell them 2 years. So the Law Society in BC says that's okay. You can let that go. The difference between what you're seeing in 5 and what you're seeing in 4, I think, is that a mistake in terms of limitation period is a mistake in how you understand the law. In other words, it was a legal error. Whereas, omitting something from a document by accident is a clerical error. It's not about practicing as a lawyer. So there they seem to draw a line and say, you can't take advantage of mistakes that are clerical. You can take it. You're allowed to take advantage of mistakes that are regarding the law. That's a very interesting distinction. This is all, again, under Law Society, Rules of Professional Conduct. What about within Judaism? Would Jewish tradition say that I have an obligation to refrain from sharp practice, not to take advantage of mistakes by opposing counsel? From a Jewish perspective, what would we say? So I'd like to look at this in terms of the way that the Law Society framed this, which is, first, the duty to the administration of justice, and then separately, the duty to society and other lawyers. So the first question is there an obligation, from a Jewish standpoint, is there an obligation to say, justice must be served, and therefore I am not allowed to take advantage of error, I'm not allowed to engage in sharp practice? What would you think? What would you suggest?
Some of these differences or distinctions are really different.
Yeah.
So when you talk about civility, doing the right thing, sometimes they are the right thing. The right thing to do is, for example, this business of I'm going to sue within the limitation period. If the lawyer said, I'm going to sue your client, and I'm going to take all appropriate action within the required time limits, other side says, well, I guess I got to get ready for court action. The person says, I'm going to do this, and I've got another 6 months because I'm within the 2-year period. It's almost a statement of, do you agree, or do you concur with this, do you not? He asks that question, or is it implied, for the other
side could just stay quiet and say, well, and so I start to think that you're starting to really, you know, I don't know if that case, I think there's room to argue that the other lawyer should have said something.
Yeah. I hear it, but the response back would be, why do they get to ask me for legal advice? Right, they didn't hire me. They're a lawyer. That's, you know, that's sort of their job. Even if there is an implied question.
Well, sometimes that's part of the civility and trying to kind of step back a minute. What are we doing in all of these things, whether it's a conflict or whether it's an agreement? We're trying to sort of agree that these are facts. And what do the facts mean? Mm-hmm. Something done incorrectly? Does somebody have a duty? So let's understand what the facts are and then try to deal with what the repercussions are from these facts. So here, though, when you start to slide the sort of the adversarial system in here,
yeah.
Then you're actually, once you're being an adversary, I know they say words like civility and doing the right thing, but by definition, the litigation world is you start to pull back a little bit from that. Mm-hmm. In commercial practice, when you're trying to do a deal, there's a mindset among some solicitors that you're both on the same team.
Right.
The team, your side, my side, trying to get this thing done. We understand what the clients want. Let's see how we can make it happen. So if you're always edging to try to give your client the advantage, are you doing the right thing? Is that being civil? Is that...
Well, part of this goes back to the question again of what we're trying to accomplish. By being civil, by not doing sharp practice, and so on, we're trying to encourage two things. Number one, make sure justice is served. And justice, as you're saying, you know, may be best served by making sure the case is decided on its merits and not on someone's technical mistake. And making sure that we're fair to other lawyers.
Isn't that how every parking ticket is dismissed? I mean, technical mistakes are...
Yes, and that will be the argument on the other side, is that we have a structure, and this is what you're supposed to follow. You play by the rules. Yes?
It's not just that. We have a duty to look up for our clients. And, you know, I can see how leading someone down on the side of the guard path to a mistake would be wrong and not civil and sharp practice. But if the other side makes a mistake that benefits our own client, I think we have to be really cognizant of not drawing something to their attention that would be contrary to our client's interests. It's a very fine line.
Right. And to go back to the parking ticket example, or let's say a speeding ticket and applying it to this, there's a difference between the me doing something to my license plate to obscure the numbers that they're going to write it down wrong, or the officer wrote it down wrong on his own, right? And that's what you're talking about, leading the person down the garden path, right? It's one thing for me to cause them to make a mistake. It's another thing to say, well, it was his problem, and therefore there are rules. He didn't conform with the rules. Therefore, it's going to get thrown out.
In the case of your limitation period, in drawing the other side about the mistake,
right.
I mean, your client doesn't want an adjudicator on this.
Right.
Client interests are not served. I mean, we all assume that justice is best served by getting to a decision on the merits. Sometimes it's not, especially if you have a crappy case.
Well, I'm going to come back to that at the end, so hold on to that one. Yes?
There's a difference between a state of fact and a state of law. Therefore, the implications of the difference is that one's you can fix in certain respects and others you can't. It's much more difficult. But what I'd ask is, in the concept of law and Jewish law, how much flexibility is there?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if the Jewish concept, I'm asking, there's a question of what's just according to Jewish law. Can you vary?
Right. And that's part of where we're going. So let's see if we end up addressing it, because I think that's a principal point we have to deal with. I want to start off the Jewish tradition part of this by dealing with relationships to the administration of justice. And this is a fundamental point. And that is that within Jewish tradition, litigation, or I shouldn't say litigation, but the pursuit of justice, is a religious pursuit. Meaning that justice and the service of justice is an opportunity for the human being to connect to God and to build up the world in the image that God desires for it. It's considered a religious responsibility. For example, the Supreme Court of the Jewish people from the period of the Second Temple for centuries was called the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin was the high court. If you didn't know, if the lower court didn't know what to do, they would kick it upstairs to this high court, the Sanhedrin. They had many different roles, but that's one of them. So the Sanhedrin met in a particular place. It was called Lishkat HaGazit, the room of hewn stone, and it was inside the temple in Jerusalem, known in Hebrew as the Beit HaMikdash. So that in the temple in Jerusalem, the place where offerings are brought to God, the holiest site for the Jewish people, that's where you have the high court meet. And I think that says a great deal. The fact that you're putting your court for people to handle their disputes, you're putting that in, basically in the central synagogue for the entire Jewish people, says that you view the administration of justice as a religious activity. And I brought an example of this in source number 6. Passage from the Talmud going back, this particular source goes back about 1900 years. Rabbi Avin bar Rav Ada says, I brought you the Hebrew as well as the English. He says, quoting Rabbi Yitzchak, "Uminayin l'shlosh sheyoshvin bedin sheshchina imahem." He says, how do we know that when three judges sit in judgment, the Shechina, God, is with them? And he goes on to quote a verse that indicates that. There's a verse from Psalms that says that God is present along with the judges. So that we find here is idea that that God wants to be with the judges, carrying out justice is a religious activity, even viewed as an act of partnership with God. Interestingly, when you look at the later prophets, the prophets from towards the end of the First Temple period, and then the beginning of the Second Temple period, so you're talking about a period that runs from about 2,000 to 2,700 years ago, and you look at what they criticized the nation for, because the job of a prophet, biblically, was not to tell the future. They did that sometimes, but that was a sort of a sideline. The main job of a prophet, biblically, is to tell people what they're doing wrong, and then get rejected by the people. That's more or less the role of a prophet. So They mainly criticize the Jews for two things. Number one is concern for idolatry, and the other is thwarting of justice and taking advantage of the vulnerable. Those are the two elements that they're concerned with, and they go side by side. And when they do that, when you juxtapose those two, that says something. It says that justice is a religious value. And if you take a look at source number 7, you find another Talmudic text, also going back, this one goes back even older, it's 2,000 to 2,100 years ago. It says, "Kol dayan shedan din emet la'amito," a judge who judges truthfully, "afilu sha'a achat," even for a moment, "is viewed by Scripture as a partner of God in creation, in creating the world." And they go on to quote a biblical verse. I didn't bring the actual verses that they quote, only because I wanted to fit this all on one page. But they talk about this as creating the world, being a partner with God in creation. If you take a look at source number 8, you find the statement that a judge who judges truthfully causes the Shechina, which is the presence of God, to be manifest in Israel. So the idea here is that there is absolutely an obligation to justice in the abstract, beyond my duty to my client because my client hired me in order to make sure that they win. But separate from that, I have an obligation to make sure that justice is served. Now here they're not speaking to lawyers, they're speaking to judges, because in the Jewish legal system traditionally, you didn't have lawyers. You had a panel of judges, and the two sides would present their case. You could go to somebody else and say, "Will you please help me present my case to the judges?" but you didn't have an official standing in the court, a position of lawyer in ancient times. Perhaps the best example of this this view of justice as a religious obligation comes from the biblical text. It's in Shemot, it's in Exodus chapters 20 and 21. Chapter 20 in Exodus tells the story of the Jews standing at Mount Sinai and receiving the Ten Commandments. It is immediately followed by chapter 21, which gives you civil law. Laws of damages between people. What happens if I gave someone something to watch and then he lost it or it got stolen? Who's responsible? Taking an oath in court. That's what happens in 21. So the biblical text goes straight from standing at Sinai and hearing God speak and having him say, I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. Don't take my name in vain. Right from that, it goes straight into Ve'ela Hamishpatim Asher Tasim Lefneihem. These are the civil laws. So that it's giving me a sense, again, that this is a religious pursuit. But it's not only about the judges. It's also about the litigants. Meaning the litigants themselves are supposed to want to have justice served. If you take a look at source number 9, the Talmud here quotes what it says was a popular statement of its day. So put yourself back into life under the Romans a couple of thousand years ago. This was a popular statement. Da'azel mi beidina shako galima. One who leaves the court bereft of his cloak. In other words, he lost the case. Right? They took the cloak and used it to pay the other side. So one who leaves the court bereft of his cloak should sing as he walks. He should be happy. Why? As the Talmud there explains, because it means he's not holding stolen property. You should be happy that you ended up being innocent in the end, and that you ended up paying for whatever the case was at hand. And based on this, it would seem that one would, number one, not want to cause somebody else to err, but number two, you wouldn't want to capitalize on somebody else's mistake that they made on their own, even if you didn't cause them to do so. At the end of the day, if they're right, they're right. I, as a person who is religious, want to make sure that I am not going to win inappropriately. Now, I recognize that that's an awfully high standard, but that's what they're putting out here as the aspiration that one is supposed to have. To say, I don't want somebody else's money. If it really should be theirs, then it should be theirs. Further, using sharp practice to cause an error would then also be wrong. If you take a look at source number 10, here's an interesting quirk. The Jewish law, traditionally, required two witnesses to testify to a particular event. If you only have one witness, you're not getting very far. So what happens if you only have one witness? And you want to fool the other side into thinking you have two. And so that's the idea that's being discussed here in source number 10 in the Code of Jewish Law. Code of Jewish Law is written down at the beginning of the 16th century. This is by Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who was a rabbi in Krakow, but he's quoting an earlier authority from the 14th century. He says, one may not listen to someone who says, come stand beside my single witness without testifying, so that my debtor will be afraid, thinking I have two witnesses, and will admit the debt. Right? In other words, I say I lend somebody money, he's denying it, I only have one witness to it, but I'm going to pretend I have two in the hope that this will intimidate him and I'll never have to actually call the witnesses in court because he'll say, uh-oh, I'm in trouble, and therefore he'll pay up. So that, to me, is a sharp practice, right? You didn't do anything. You didn't break any laws. But it's clearly meant to convey something to the other side that isn't true. And Rabbi Isserles here in source number 10, recorded in the Code of Jewish Law, says not to do so. So from the perspective of relationship to justice, we see a very strict standard. Saying that, you can't do something that's going to warp justice. However, there is, and we already mentioned this a little bit, there is a flaw in this argument. And the flaw in this argument is, if society has made up a set of rules, such as the police officer recording your license plate has to get it right, and if he doesn't get it right, then there's no ticket, or apply it to whatever else you want to apply it to, maybe that is part of administration of justice. And you're not thwarting justice, because that's the way justice is supposed to be executed. So the argument could still be made that the justice is more than just paying the debt, it's actually conforming with all the rules that surround claiming payment of the debt. You follow? That's the questionable part of this. But this is within one category. That's relationship to justice. What about relationship to the society and other lawyers? Again, recognizing there is no formal position of lawyer in the classic Jewish judicial system, nonetheless, there is what we call in Hebrew, Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. Bein Adam L'Chaveiro means my responsibility to other people. Social relationships. And there, we have a great deal of literature within Jewish tradition. You may have heard of the biblical verse, Leviticus chapter 19, sentence 18, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Right? Familiar? V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, that's one. Another one in the same chapter, V'asita hayashar v'hatov. You shall do that which is just and good, or that which is righteous and good. There's an obligation for a person to conduct himself properly with others, and that translates into law. Take a look at source number 11, please, the top of the second side. This is always a remarkable case. Actually, did you hear about, this goes back about 3 years, I think, the Talmud in South Korea thing? Not familiar at all? Okay, so this was remarkable. I should have put a link on here. I didn't think about it until I looked at the case. There was an article that went around Jewish websites. It was a big hit about 3 years ago. That it seems that in South Korea, it's become very popular to teach Talmud to children. Not Jewish children. To teach Talmud to children in general on the theory that the way that law is handled is very good for teaching them logic. And that the ethics are also admirable and good to teach to the kids. And so what they did is they actually created a series of comic books in which they take cases like the one here. That's what reminded me of it. And actually, like they have Talmud comic books, more or less, that they use to teach the children. It's a remarkable thing. If I'm sitting there and listening to this, I'm thinking, I don't really believe this. So do me a favor. You can email me. My email address is on the top of the sheet on the first side, and I will send you a link to it, because I didn't believe it either until I actually saw it. But in any case, this is one of the cases that they illustrated. It's a case involving a mill. And take a look in number 11, and you'll see how it plays out. A man rented out a mill to another one, to another man, in exchange for doing his grinding. In other words, I own a mill. There's somebody else who needs to use a mill. He can't afford to actually pay me for it. So I say to him, that's okay. You do your milling. You do my milling as well. And we'll call it even. You're paying me for the use of my mill by grinding my grain. That's the arrangement. But what happened? In the end, he, this tenant of the mill, so to speak, who's using it, became wealthy. And he purchased another mill with a donkey. So that now he doesn't need to worry about using my mill at all. He has a donkey who can do the grinding and so on. But what he now wants to do is he's using my mill not just to grind his own grain. He's essentially creating, I suppose, like a franchise, where he wants to now be the not owner, but the manager of mills, and people will come to him and pay rent in order to be able to use the mills that he has. You follow? He's like subletting my mill, is effectively what he's doing. This fellow became wealthy. He has a mill for himself. He doesn't need to use my mill to grind his grain. But he wants to continue the arrangement with me. So the tenant said, the landlord says to the tenant, until now I had you do my milling, and that was the way you rented my mill. Now, you have money, I'd rather that you pay me money for it. The tenant said, I would continue to grind for you. I would much rather not pay you cash, I would rather you know what, I'm sorry, I misstated the case. Let me make sure I get this right. That's my own fault for not reading the Aramaic instead of reading the English. The case is this. We're going to give people names, that'll make it easier. You have I don't know, Charlie and Sally. Charlie owns the mill. Sally wants to use the mill. Charlie says to Sally, you can use this mill, and the payment that you have to give me is simply to grind my grain. So Sally is using the mill to grind hers, and also using the mill to grind Charlie's grain. Clear? That's the way it's set up initially. Charlie is the one who then becomes wealthier. And Charlie is able to get an animal, a donkey, that he's able to use to grind the grain. Because remember the way their mills work. You had these very large stones. It was a large disc, and then you put the grain on top of it, and then there was another disc on top of that, and you turned that big upper millstone in order to grind the grain between the two. This was hard work. So Charlie now is wealthy enough that he has a donkey that can do that. And therefore, he has no benefit from having Sally take care of grinding up his grain. So he turns to Sally and says, "You're free to continue to use my mill, but you're going to have to pay me now. Grinding up my grain is not going to work." So that's our case. So the tenant says, Sally says, "I will be glad to continue to grind up the grain. I don't have the money to pay you." Right, so we're assuming the contract is still in force. It's a good question. It's the same question I always get on this case. So you're 100% right. The answer is the contract is still in force. This is not when they're creating a new term. Landlord wants to renegotiate, precisely. So if the landlord has grain for grinding, meaning there is something to be ground up, then in a case like this, we compel him to avoid what we call Midat Sodom, the manner of Sodom. Sodom is the biblical city in which they are very hostile to guests. They do not want to share with others. And what we're saying here is, the landlord doesn't lose anything by letting Sally continue to grind the grain. He'll use the donkey for something else. He wants to be able to get cash from her. And so he's renegotiating for cash. But that's inappropriate. In the rule is that he has to say, "I'm going to let her continue under the old terms rather than try to take advantage of the situation." Let's say we're not even talking about continuing on the same contract. Let's say we're talking about where there is no contract. Let's say it's an auto renewal. Okay, they did this already for a year, and the terms are that it renews automatically at the end of each term. What we're saying is the landlord has to stick to the original terms and does not have, he has the legal rights technically, but we don't want him to act in that way. That's considered to be the trait of Sodom in the sense that he's taking advantage of the other party. And the and so we tell him, Go back with the original agreement that you had. That's the idea here. So what we're suggesting here is that I have obligations of proper conduct towards others. That's really the upshot of this particular case and the principle of love your neighbor as yourself. And it has applications in the realm of sharp practice in particular. Take a look at source number 12. This is a passage from Maimonides. In his work of law that he records end of the 12th century, he records an idea that's much older than him. He writes, "One who interacts with a Jew or a non-Jewish idolater, doesn't make a difference, measuring or weighing dishonestly, violates a prohibition and is obligated to refund the money." I'm sorry, he didn't know any atheists, so this was his way of phrasing it. He says, if you interact with a Jew or a non-Jew, doesn't matter. He says, if you measure or weigh dishonestly, you violate a prohibition and you're obligated to refund the money. That's his statement. Similarly, one may not trick a non-Jew in accounting. One must be precise. He goes out of the way of he's going out of his way to say it because he knows that people don't necessarily have that knowledge. In other words, there are people who will assume for your family you do one thing and for others you do something else, and therefore he's going out of his way to say this law applies no matter whom you're dealing with. And he quotes a verse in Deuteronomy, "It is abhorrent before God to do these things, to perform any corrupt act in any form." Now, going back to the distinction we made before, between causing an error and taking advantage of somebody else's error, he's only talking here about causing an error. Look at his examples, right? Weighing something or measuring something dishonestly, tricking somebody in accounting. Those are where you are the one who actually did something wrong. And that's where you're in violation. My duty to other people may not include the obligation to correct them on their mistake. The upshot of what we've said so far is that Judaism recognizes a relationship with the administration of justice in general, I am obligated to make sure justice is served, and that's true for the judge, and that's true for the litigant. And then, in terms of obligations to other people, I also have a strong obligation towards others, although that may not include correcting their mistake. It does include not causing the mistake actively, not doing anything myself to cause the mistake. Are we clear so far? Okay, there's one problem case, and this goes back to a point that you made in the beginning.
Question?
Yeah.
An act versus an omission.
Yeah.
Justice, religious connection to justice. So I would have thought that justice couldn't be altered by technicalities. But now I'm making a distinction between commission and omission. So you're paying for something, it's $10, you give $9, that's your commission, you're doing something wrong. You pay for something, and they give you back too much change, that's their mistake, you can keep the money.
So that's it. What you started to say before is exactly right. In other words, from a standpoint of relationship with justice, I have to give back the change. From the standpoint of relationship with other people, I might be able to argue that where they made the mistake, it's not my problem. But the first point, relationship with justice, is still going to trump that and say I have to give back the change. So under my relationship with others, maybe if they make a mistake, that's their problem. But under my relationship with justice, it's my problem as well. The practical difference would be, what if we argue that taking advantage of a technicality is part of the justice system?
That's a rule we create.
Correct.
Okay, so that means it's an artificial set of rules because it just gets us through our lives. And what it does, though, is it allows self-interest to trump justice.
And that's right. That's one argument. The response could potentially be that that's social contract, and that comes to define justice. We do that in Jewish law in general. For many different areas of sub-areas of law, we say that you follow social custom. So, for example, the Talmud discusses the case in which you hire somebody and you don't specify the hours. We're not talking about like a law firm where it may be more, you can't have that. Right. I'm talking about you hired a worker for your field. So the question now is, what do we assume is the commitment from the employee? And the answer is, if nothing was stated, you go with whatever is the norm socially. The taxation is established by social contract. All sorts of rules will be governed by how people normally do business. So the answer could be the technicality is also going to be, because it's accepted by everybody, that's going to become justice. But here's my problem case. What if I want to use sharp practice in order to help a victim get that which is his due, where I feel the victim has been cheated? Now what do you do? So, in other words, I am the lawyer. I believe that my client is right. Never mind whether all lawyers believe all clients are right. In this particular case, I believe my client is right. My client has been wronged by the system, and my client's going to lose the case. I have the opportunity to use sharp practice in order to help my client win. I'm not going to be winning on the merits. Right? As someone said before, my client's case is lousy. It's just the way it is. But my client is right. So if I can use sharp practice in order to, as I feel, right a wrong, or as I called it on the sheet, sharp practice in pursuit of justice, am I entitled to do that? So I asked a few lawyers this question in terms of the general system and the law society, what would happen in the event that you did that? Could you defend yourself by saying, well, my client was right? And they sort of laughed. That's not an adequate defense. That's my understanding from what I've been told. But within Jewish law, you could actually argue both ways. First of all, the side in favor, the side that says yes, you could actually use sharp practice. You could trigger someone else's mistake or take advantage of a technicality because you believe you're righting a wrong. This idea is presented in a few different cases. I gave you one example in source number 13. There is a rule that says that if you are a borrower, you're not allowed to drag out repayment of debt in order to get a settlement. In other words, if you're just going to drag things out and challenge in ways that, make the process take forever, eventually the creditor is going to say, you know what, let's just settle. So ordinarily the rule is one is not allowed to do this. But take a look at source number 13. Sorry? I'm sorry. The Code of Jewish Law, Choshen Mishpat 12:6, says you can't. Okay, that's what I'm coming back to here. So take a look. Rabbi Yaakov Lorberbaum of Lisa wrote a commentary to the Code of Jewish Law, and he writes, "If one knows that the truth is with him, but the court will not trust him, I know that my client is right, but the court isn't accepting it, then he may seek ways to instigate a compromise, a settlement. He must only avoid acting as a wicked person before the court. As long as you don't break the law, you can try tactics that will lead to what you believe is justice." That's the...
What if you don't believe necessarily that your client is right? Can you still do that?
So, according to this, no.
You have to
be right. That's the...
How do you know you're right?
Yeah, and that's always the problem.
Go back to your earlier example,
yeah,
where it was the creditor has the
one witness, yes.
So if in fact the creditor is owed the money and he actually has a witness,
mm-hmm,
the money's owed.
Yep.
The fact that he's got one or two other people standing beside him, one of your examples was thou shalt not do that, but this would suggest, I think that's not sharp practice, but this would suggest not only is it not sharp practice, it may or may not be sharp practice, but in the circumstances of obtaining justice...
It would be an acceptable tactic. Yeah, that's what it sounds like. That's certainly what this position sounds like. And we have other sources that support this. So source number 14... deals with the problem of tax collectors in Roman times. In Roman times, you have what were called tax farmers. And the idea of a tax farmer is that he would pay the government for the right to collect taxes, which he would then keep for himself. And he could decide on his own how he's going to tax people. It could be based on, I like this person, I'm going to give him a break. I don't like that person, I'm going to charge him double. So what the Talmud says is, you're not allowed, in source number 14, you're not allowed to make change using coins from the tax collector's box, because they are viewed as stolen goods, because this tax collector, this tax farmer, is cheating people. And then the Talmud on that, in source number 14, they ask, well, wait a minute, don't we say the law of the land is the law? How could you tell me that that it's considered stolen? We honor the law of the land. And his answer is, yeah, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, I'm going a little quickly with this in the interest of time, but we're talking about a tax collector, a tax farmer who doesn't have a fixed rate. He's just doing it based on whatever appeals to him, and that's considered theft. So, and they talk about a self-appointed tax collector as well. That's what we call a thief. But the point is that the Talmud there discusses the possibility of lying to this person who is an illegitimate collector of taxes. He comes to your house and he says, oh, you have this very fine item. You know there's a tax on that. You say to him, that's not mine. I'm actually holding that as collateral on a debt. Or I'm holding it on behalf of somebody else, or whatever it is. So that is considered to be acceptable. You are allowed to, you'll be allowed to tell him that untruth, and that would not be considered a violation, because it is in the greater interests of proper justice, because what he's doing is fundamentally theft.
Something similar in the criminal law context, not that much. Our system, if your client tells you an essential fact that if you're representing as a defendant, he tells you an essential fact that goes to the merits of the crime, you can't represent your client or suggest that evidence isn't there. You basically have to keep your mouth shut about that. Like, you can't knowingly let your client go off the clock.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, is the rule.
Right.
It's sort of little lesser than number 13. You have to avoid acting as the wicked Right. You almost fit into 13.
Interesting.
But on the other hand, if you know that they're guilty, you have no obligation to plead guilty, and you can put a crown to a certain disproof of proving beyond a reasonable doubt, that you can use whatever tactic possible to show that the crown is
but you can't plead the evidence, the wicked part, you can't plead the evidence to dispute a particular fact that your client's admitted to you.
Right. Criminal law in general in Judaism will be different because you have an imperative.
It's different also in Canadian.
Right. Actually, you know what the truth is? The differences are the same. In the sense that the default assumption in Jewish law regarding a criminal case is that you're obligated to try to find, the judges are obligated to try to find the defendant innocent. That's the default. The Tzilu Ha'idah is the biblical text. They're responsible to try to find the person innocent, so that the Talmudic discussions about carrying out corporal punishment, they talk about how they would interrogate witnesses in absurd ways. Like, you say the crime took place under a fig tree, were the stems on the figs thick or thin? And if one witness says they were thick and the other one says, I don't know, or they were thin, the case is thrown out. Even though it has nothing to do with the actual event that took place, they would go very far to try to exonerate the defendant. You really force the crown, so to speak, to prove its case. Yeah.
You're innocent until proven guilty, it's the same.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The systems are parallel in that regard.
That's just here's your justice tempered by legalities, technicalities, and forcing the crown to show that they have met the standard of every technical requirement.
Right.
Even though you know your client's guilty, and you're hammering away at the witness to try to find out if the stem of the fig was thick or thin.
Right. But again, that's criminal specifically. That's in criminal law. So I've given you a couple of sources that show that from a Jewish tradition standpoint, if your client is right, and you believe the client is right, you're now going to be able to engage in sharp practice. I have one more case here, number 15, but I'm going to say it outside just in the interest of time. Rav Moshe Sofer, writing in Hungary in the 18th century, deals with the following rule. Certain witnesses are disqualified for criminal conduct of their own. They're not acceptable as witnesses, or even not criminal conduct. But certain types of behaviors will disqualify a witness. A gambler, for example, even if what he's doing is not illegal, is disqualified as a witness in a Jewish court. What that means, defining gambling, is a great discussion for another time. But the point is that, let's say, I am going to be a witness, and the person they're going to pair up with me is disqualified from testifying. And I know that. Am I allowed to testify alongside him and not say anything and not mention to anybody that the other witness is actually disqualified? So Rabbi Moshe Sofer suggests, if you know that your testimony is true, you don't need to worry about the status of the other witness. Because what you're saying is true. If they decide to investigate and throw it out, that's another story. But that's not your obligation. You present your honest testimony and don't worry about what's going on with the other witness. That's on the side of saying you can do it because you're serving justice. But there are sources that indicate otherwise. If you take a look at source number 16, Maimonides' commentary to the work Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot itself is a work that's over 2,000 years old. Maimonides is commenting on it in the 12th century. He says, even where one knows that this party has been cheated and that the opposing litigant is lying, one may in no way teach him claims that will assist him. He's commenting on a line in Pirkei Avot that says, you, speaking to a judge, are not allowed to act as a lawyer. That's the line that's in Pirkei Avot. You're not allowed, as a judge, you're not allowed to act on behalf of one of the sides. So he explains that to me, that if the two sides are before you, and you believe that one of them is right, but he's just not presenting his case properly, you're not allowed to help him present his case. Even though it's in the pursuit of justice, and you'll say, well, I want him to win because he's right, the judge is not allowed to engage in this activity. And I'll give you one more example of this. From the Talmud, in source number 17. The following case. again, I'll say it outside of the actual text. Let's say you have three people who collectively are owed $100. The defendant is denying the debt. They don't have witnesses. So they say, look, there are three of us. One of us is going to claim that he owes him $100. The other two are going to say we are witnesses to that fictional debt. There was no such debt. But we are going to act as though there was such a debt because really he owes the three of us $100. So this way, the two of us are going to make sure that he ends up paying it, and then we'll split it among ourselves. And justice is served. So the Talmud there says you're not allowed to do it. It quotes a biblical verse, Midvar Sheker Tirchak, distance yourself from falsehood. So I have sources that indicate that yes, if you are serving justice, you are allowed to engage in sharp practice that we saw before in sources 13, 14, 15. And then on the other end, in 16 and 17, we're seeing sources that indicate that no, you would not be allowed to do so. I don't think it's a simple and straightforward thing. It's obviously also a risky game because you have to be right. If you're wrong, then now you're burning the justice system. You know, number one is you're engaging in an inappropriate practice, and number two, the result is that justice is not served. So you have to know what you're doing if you're going to engage in this. But that's a case in which you can see multiple positions. So the upshot of this is that under the rules of professional conduct, we say that there is a principle of relationship to the administration of justice which requires that you not engage in sharp practice, that you be civil. We didn't really get to discuss civility, so maybe that'll be on another occasion. But it requires that you act in good faith towards others and that you avoid sharp practice. I'm sorry, that you engage under relationship to the administration of justice, that you have to make sure to act with candor and mention all relevant binding authority. And then in terms of your relationship with the law society and other lawyers, you have to act in good faith and avoid sharp practice and be civil. We have these two separate responsibilities. From a Jewish tradition standpoint, there's a very high standard of relationship with the administration of justice because that's considered a religious duty and you're supposed to be happy if you lose because that means that you didn't cheat anybody. And therefore I can't, not only may I not lead someone else to error, I can't take advantage of error. And then second, my responsibility to other people, I can't cause them. I'm not allowed to cause them to make a mistake. The big question is, what if I'm actually pursuing justice? And you want to use sharp practice in order to accomplish that end, and that I think is subject to considerable debate. Right. Should I take 3 minutes on civility, or are we at the end? Okay, so just 3 minutes on civility. One thing that I found very interesting in the discussion in the rules of professional conduct is that civility, as it's presented there, is not really about be nice to other people, but it's about if you're not nice to other people, then you damage the legal profession. Meaning that if you don't act with candor or if you don't act respectfully, then people will think poorly of lawyers. So therefore you should. That's the way it seems to be worded in various places where this is discussed. Whether that's a lost cause or not, I can't speak to. But my wife is a lawyer, so I'm safe saying that. But the within Jewish tradition, you actually have both sides represented. You have the idea of purely you should act in a good way, in a kind way, in a respectful way towards other people. We saw already, I mentioned earlier, love your neighbor as yourself. There's the biblical verse in the beginning of Genesis that says that God creates human beings in the image of God. Whatever that means is a good question, but the idea is that we are supposed to treat each other with the respect that we would give to God. We're supposed to treat each other properly. That's number one. But number two, there is also this idea that if you treat other people in an unkind way, then you give, in the case of Judaism, you give the system of Judaism a bad name. So that the Talmud suggests, there's a biblical verse that says, you shall love your God. And all the sages are bothered by that. What does that mean, to love God? And they give various explanations, but one particular Talmudic passage says it means that you should cause others to love God. How do you do that? What does that mean? Judaism is not an evangelical religion, so what does that mean, you should cause others to love God? And the Talmud says, the answer is, play nicely with others. Because the more, it says the Masau umatano benachat im habriyot. One's interactions should be gentle with other people. And as the Talmud there says, that will cause people to say, okay, this is a system worth respecting. This is a system that's worth honoring. That's a God who I can love when you deal with other people in a respectful way. Now, that's from a Jewish standpoint, but it parallels what you're seeing in the rules of professional conduct. They're saying there is that the lawyer has to make sure to be civil and courteous and respectful so that people will respect the legal system. Jewish sources are saying likewise, that one needs to be civil and respectful and so on. Number one, because of your relationship with others, but number two, so that people really will respect the system that you represent. So that's the civility point in a nutshell. Thank you very much.